No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the discussion. We'd love to have some questions. So call in at 888-627-6008 and ask Maria a question. Or you can ask me, even ask me a question, but Maria's opinions are much more valuable than mine. And welcome, Maria.
Hello, Michael, and it's great to be with you, as always, these five-plus years now. And a great friendship, too, I might add, and that with Mrs. Brown as well. I consider her a friend, too, so I appreciate you allowing me into your lives and into your home and into your family.
Well, the feeling is mutual, and nobody ever expected, I got to tell you, never expected it to last this long and to develop, you know, that really is a bonus that I've gotten a friend out of the deal. You're an amazing person. I'm so honored that you would even take the time to be with me an hour every Sunday for 5 years. So thank you so much for that. I think that you've really made a difference on the show.
Well, you know, I tell people, because people say, having been a talk radio host for, it's over 25 years, and most of my career here in Los Angeles, people say, what do you talk about? And I say, the Maria Sanchez show that I used to do was about current events, lifestyle, health, relationships, very little politics, because I always said there was a lot of angry white men that did it, and who wants to get into that fray? And then your program, Shadow Politics, is, I would say, by and large, mostly about politics in general, but it's, I would say we're probably as nonpartisan and objective as a broadcast can be with two people from different persuasions and on different coasts.
Well, and that was the idea of the show, right? Is to show that there are many things that unite us, even though you're a Republican and I'm a Democrat. You know, now I told you earlier when we talked that my children don't see me, you know, they see me as an angry white guy, which really surprises me to some extent. But they come from a different place. You know, they see the world standing in a different place. And I think the single most important thing that I've learned in life is what Albert Einstein said, as far as politics goes. And that is that what you see depends on where you stand. You know, you and I stand in different positions. You're a woman. I'm a man. You're on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast. You're a Republican. I'm a Democrat. But we also stand together on a lot of issues. And that's what's important, because that's really what America needs right now. We need to come together on some basic issues that I know we all care about. We all love this country. I don't think that people out there that voted for Donald Trump or voted for Joe Biden, I don't think they're different in that respect. I think that they both have different concerns and different fears. But I think that for the most part, the vast majority of people that live in this country love this country. We hear very few people say, you know, I wish I didn't live in the United States. It's really a great country, and we need to find those things.
And I agree with you. I think really, at the end of the day, we're Americans first, and then we're this, that, or the other. And if we can reflect upon that and know that that's what does unite us, I think that we'll see less differences and more commonalities, because at the end of the day, we are more alike than we're not, I think, regardless of race or ethnicity or color of skin or education or socioeconomic or geographic, we're human beings.
Yeah, and, you know, we do have some common things in, you know, not only a love for our country, a love for our families. Who doesn't love their children or their family and friends and extended family? I mean, these are the issues that we need to come together on. And I hope that one of the positive things, I mean, it's hard to think of what positive thing is going to come out of the coronavirus, but I hope that's one of those things, you know, that we certainly saw it when we, after 9/11, for example. We saw how New Yorkers, who are supposed to be the most contentious people on the planet, come together around that crisis, you know, and how America came together around that crisis. And I hope this is something that happens with coronavirus, because we've been attacked. We've been attacked by this virus that doesn't care who you are, how rich you are, how poor you are. You know, I hope this is one of the positive things that we bring out of this.
Well, I mean, I don't know that we're ever going to be able to get back to normal after this. In fact, one of my sons and his new wife, new bride, I should say, came for a visit, and I haven't seen them since November 1st, and they entered through the side gate. We're having a beautiful day here in Los Angeles. It was like 82 degrees.
Wow.
And we sat outside with masks on. They refused any food or beverage, and I was at least 10 feet away from them. They sat together, obviously, because they're in the same household. And my son was saying, like, so do you think we're going to have to get an injection every year, like the flu shot? And I said, I think so, because they don't know how long the vaccine lasts, the one that's being given now.
Yeah, and we've already seen, right, in England, right, now they're talking about a mutated version,
right,
which isn't any more severe, but do we know how resistant it is to the vaccine, or whether it will be resistant at all?
Right.
Yeah, I think this is a new age, and I think we're going to have to make real adjustments. And let me just, on a personal note, say something that, you know, I was tested last week for COVID because I sat in a room with two people that weren't wearing masks who both tested positive for COVID, and I was probably less than 6 feet away from them at times because they're my dear, dear friends. And you know what? I didn't get COVID because I wore a mask.
Now, so why did they not wear a mask?
Because they were in their house, and they were, you know, they're a married couple, and the two of them were in the house, and so they don't wear masks in the house. I don't wear masks in my house with my wife, but they were unaware that they had COVID at the time. And then, of course, the very next day, two people that they had been, my friend Pete plays in a band, and several people in the band had come down with COVID, and he came down with COVID. And then his wife was tested, and she had it. So they called me, and you know, certainly they were infectious at that point, because this was a Friday, and they got tested on Saturday, and they both tested positive. So, you know, I went on, I don't know, Monday or Tuesday, and got tested, and I wasn't. So masks work
Thank
both
goodness.
Ways. Yeah, thank goodness.
And here I'm outside with a mask on.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to my son and daughter-in-law, when we're 10 feet apart, can't we take our masks off? And they said no. And you know what they say? Mom, if we infected you, I could never live that down. So
right.
They're doing it for me, which I'm appreciative of that. But it seems that at some point, you know, if nobody's coughing or sneezing, then things aren't flying. Right. And I know it exists in the air, but we are outdoors and there is a breeze. So, I mean, I guess you can't ever be too conservative, but still, I guess it's better than being too liberal in terms of, you know, not obeying protocols.
Yeah. And that's it. I absolutely agree with that. Although I hardly ever agree with being too conservative, but I do agree with that. I do agree with that. I mean, it's just, you know, my kids are the same way. They wear masks in the house, both of them. One of them comes in and out. One of them works at a hardware store. Uh-huh. So he's always wearing a mask and he's always social distancing. But even the two girls that have been here, you know, they've been here now a week, they still wear masks all the time. And
really?
And I get that. And they say the same thing. It's not about us, Dad. It's about you. You know, it's you're a diabetic. You're over 65. You know, we just want to make sure we're keeping you safe.
That's
so
sweet.
I'm a parent, so some of me thinks it's only because it's close to Christmas and they don't want me to kick off before I give them all nice presents on Christmas Day. But
no, stop.
But that's the cynic in me.
Yes.
I mean, I appreciate it. And I do. I feel the same way you do about it a little bit. And maybe that's because, you know, we come from a different place again. I think it's a little bit of overkill, but I don't say anything about it because, you know, if it makes them feel better, for that reason alone, we should do it.
Yes. So tell me, can you share a little bit more about how you think because there's something to be said for naivete and innocence with feelings about our world. Because I think, you know, how they say about if you don't have a heart when you're young, then, you know, you can't have a brain when you're older kind of thing in terms of politics and whatnot. What is your perspective? Because my three sons all were Biden fans, and then before that, Bernie fans. So huge Bernie fans, as a matter of fact. And philosophically, I disagreed with Bernie Sanders, but I respected my son's opinions, and they're smart, and they don't just do it because they look into it, they investigate, they do reading, they research, they're huge fans too. So that's where they get a lot of their news. How is it that you think that your children might be a little naive in regards to politics because of where they see our world?
Well, I don't know that I think they're naive. I think that, you know, the same thing was true of them, Maria. My daughter was, my oldest daughter was Elizabeth Warren fan, and they both were Bernie fans, I was a fan of both those candidates too, but I felt that Joe Biden could win the election, and that was important because I thought America wanted to be comforted and they wanted somebody that they could depend on, someone who they knew, who they liked, and who they could depend on. And I thought Joe Biden was that guy. So I would say that my opinion was, rather than their opinion being naive, I would say that my opinion was more jaded, that I felt that Bernie couldn't win. I felt he couldn't win. You know, I like Bernie Sanders personally. He's done personal favors for me on Capitol Hill, you know, but I thought, I didn't think he could win. I thought that when he came out and he said he was a democratic socialist, that was just a poison pill for him. I studied socialism when I was in college. I got no problem with it, you know, but America has a problem with that particular label. And I think Biden's been right about defund the police in that regard. I think that what people are saying in Black Lives Matter and other groups that want to change the way we do policing in America, I agree with that. It's just that that tag phrase turns a lot of people off. And that's what I was afraid of with Bernie. I was afraid that he was turning people off, and I thought we had a priority to change the administration. So,
and so that shows about how you're hazarding an opinion based on electability, not necessarily based motivations or policies, which I learned later in life, because I used to always be about, well, what's right is right. And, you know, that's not, you know, whatever. And then as I got older, I realized there's a lot of gray here. It isn't black and white. It isn't wrong or right. It's nuances. It's subtleties. It's perceptions, which might not necessarily be true, but perception goes a long way with people. And so I reluctantly became more sage, like you just mentioned, when I did, the idealistic individual in me didn't want to. So, well, and I think that happened to Hillary Clinton too, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people did want to see a woman in the White House, but her unlikability factor was overwhelming, and her femaleness didn't dominate that.
Yeah, and that's a strange thing about politics. Is that people have to like you, to elect you. And you know, that may sound silly on the surface, but what I mean by that is that you have to have a personality that they like. And if you thought about the person running your company, let's say you had a woman running your company and you really didn't like her, but she was making the company grow, and you know, your
shareholder profits,
and you were getting big raises and everything was good, you'd say, you know, she's not my favorite person, but she's doing a great job. Well, that doesn't happen in politics. She even if they're doing a good job, you got to like them to elect them. And you're right, she had a very high
I don't know if you'd call it favorability.
And you know what, look, I've said this a couple of times on the air, and this is so important to me. Right after she lost the election, I went to speak to a bunch of women. And a woman stood up in the crowd and she said, look, as Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for. And I said, you're wrong. We do have something to apologize for, because we helped put this man in the White House, as well as the Republicans. It wasn't just the Republicans. You know, if the Democrats had reached out better to America, if we understood America better, and what Americans wanted better, and we were fulfilling their needs, then the Democrat would have been elected. And I think that's something that we need to deal with. 74 million people voted for this guy. You know, right. We won. Hooray, we won. But 74 million people voted for this guy. So we got to do a better job reaching out.
And which is the most ever for someone who lost.
Right. Most ever for anybody, except Biden. The only person to ever get more votes than him was Biden. And you know, I think that Biden is certainly attempting to do that right now. If you look at his cabinet picks, you know, he's trying to assemble a cabinet that looks more like America. He's nominated the first Native American to be cabinet secretary of the Interior. Now, when I think of that, because I work with Native Americans, you know, I've done.
Yeah, give our listeners the backstory about that, because I think that was really going to inform what it is that you have to say about the nominee.
Well, you know, it's just a funny circumstance that my sister was an Indian lawyer, did work for Native Americans, as well as being a corporate lawyer. But so one day I'm sitting around. It's just before the election. John Kerry is about to be is running for election. And somebody calls me and says, don't you know a lot of Indians? And I'm like, no, I don't know a lot of Indians. This is somebody from the DNC. And they said, well, didn't you tell me a story once about Indians? And I said, well, yeah. I mean, when I was 18, I went across America and I stayed on a bunch of Indian reservations and I met Indians because of my sister's connections. And they say, great, you're perfect. We're sending you out to a reservation in the middle of Minnesota. And I said, oh, these guys are really desperate. They're looking for anybody. You know, the next question, if I said no to that, would have been, don't you have an Indian nickel in your pocket? They wanted any connection to send me out. So they sent me out. And I campaigned on three Indian reservations in Minnesota, and we actually won them, and we won the state of Minnesota, but unfortunately John Kerry lost. But that's where I got connected to a group called Indians List, and they trained. The idea was they would train Native Americans who wanted to run for public office, and so I got involved. I was intrigued by that. And I did a direct mail training in and a campaign training, because I've done a lot of campaigning in my life, in Minnesota. And they actually gave me an award at the next training in California for being one of their top trainers. And I was very honored by that. So I stayed involved with the organization. And I met a lot of Native Americans through that organization. Unfortunately, they weren't able to raise enough money, and they stopped doing the trainings. But out of, like, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think we trained 32 candidates, and something like 27 of them got elected. So
wow.
Yeah, it was really, really effective. And they got elected to everything, school board. And, you know, we have one person that ran for Congress in Alaska. She didn't make it. But there were people. We got this. We got the head of the Senate, the state Senate in Oklahoma, elected. Excuse me. And he was a man that had grown up in a house where they had no running water or no electricity. And he became the Speaker of the House of Oklahoma. So wow. We got some amazing people elected. And as I reflect on the fact that they've named this Native American in Congress, he's named her as his Secretary of the Interior.
Right.
And I don't know how many women have ever held that job. I don't think too many. But, you know, as I reflect on that, I say, why wasn't this more obvious? These people, and by these people I mean Native Americans, come from a culture where the environment is at the center of it.
Yes.
They have great respect for the earth, which they see as mother to us all. In fact, there were many tribes that didn't even understand the concept of private ownership of land. They felt like the land belonged to everybody.
Belonged to some other earth.
Yeah.
Well,
why haven't we done this earlier?
That office is the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Right, it is.
And the National Park Foundation. And right. I mean, yeah, it goes like, duh. And these are the people that respect our planet and our soil. That's a part. It's sacred to them.
That's right. And also, you should know, if you think General Custer wasn't nice to the Indians, you should look at what the Bureau of Land Management has done to the Indians over the years. They've just been absolutely dreadful. So it's great. I mean, maybe not as much now as they were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but that's how I got involved to begin with, because my sister sued the federal government on behalf of Native Americans and won. Because the Bureau of Land Management was so horrible. But, you know, in addition to appointing the first Native American, also the first woman Secretary of the Treasury, mm-hmm. Janet Yellen, also the
and
first...
And boy, is she qualified.
She is qualified, yes. And the first openly gay cabinet member in...
Pete Buttigieg.
Pete, yeah, Mayor Pete. You know, so... And
but you know what's interesting too, though, Michael, about because they say that his picks are going to make the probably one of the most diverse ever cabinets in history. But Representative Jim Clyburn weighed in this week about that, and he said, you know, along with diversity and race and ethnicity, you have to have substance. And right. He said, you need people who've lived the Black or Latina experience because of their minority experience, but there has to be there, which, in other words, he just doesn't want tokenisms.
Right.
And he even mentioned that he and his wife, who were both African-American, had very different experiences growing up. She had to walk 2 miles to school because only white people got bused, and he had to walk 3 blocks from school. And he said, and just because we had the same skin color, we had an entirely different experience. And that diversity, when you bring that to the room and it's at the table and it's in the conversation, can only make for better decisions.
Well, and, you know, and we've seen this in the past, right? We've seen, you and I are both sports fans. Mm-hmm. Let's look back at the first women's sportscasters we ever saw, right? They mm-hmm. were all very pretty, mm-hmm. And, you know, but not particularly knowledgeable. Now we see women out there on the playing field that not only know as much as the men, but many of them who have been athletes themselves, none of which the first ones were, the first football announcers, none of them were athletes. They were more likely news people or fashion models. So right. we, you know, but now we see, we had one here in Washington named Lindsay Zarniak, who was just, she's now married to, can't remember who she married, a famous football player or a sportscaster or something, but she's moved to New York. But when she was in Washington, let me tell you, nobody knew more about our football team than she did.
I'm happy to hear that, because I still think that it's always the women that are relegated to the sideline reporting, because the Terry Bradshaw group with Howie Long and that, I always, because I do watch the NFL, I'm a huge fan, I always feel like they're never including me in the conversation. It's the yuck with the old boys and the, you know, whatever. And I'm dying to see a woman be on a panel like that. Well, I'm the first year in football. I used to do color announcing for football games with an NFL player, a retired NFL player. I know the game. I know the sport. And I don't hear those guys talking to me. And that bothers me in this day and age. But we do have one female ref, right, or umpire in the NFL right now. Yeah. I mean, why did that take so long? I used to ref basketball games back in the day, and only one. There wasn't two of us. And you're running back and forth up and down the court with a whistle in your mouth. You have to be in fantastic shape to be able to do that. And it's like, we're still backwards in terms of gender. Not so much in terms of diversity, but in terms of gender, I think we are. After all, we're 50% of the population.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny that I never thought of that, what you just said about the, you know, about the halftime show and stuff. There should be a woman on that.
Yeah, there's not a one.
But, you know, a woman would so intimidate Terry Bradshaw and Howie. You know, they would just, a knowledgeable woman. I'm not sure that those guys, because they're old school.
I think I had the occasion to meet the five years ago in studio, brought my four children. And Howie Long was so gracious with my sons. They were in high school and playing football. And he said to them, go for the education, the sport will find you, which he's case in point. I think he went to Fordham and got found by the NFL.
Yeah.
But Terry Bradshaw wouldn't even turn around and swivel around to say hello. He was just pompous, arrogant, like whatever. So granted, he didn't know me or the kids, but Howie was just so sweet. And then there was another guy on who used to be a coach, a little guy somewhere in the Midwest. He was sweet too, but yeah. But, yeah, there should be a woman there. Come on, there's five of them.
And you know, Howie Long just looks like a great guy. He was he just comes off as a really nice guy. Of course, he was a terror on the football team.
Yeah, but that's why I don't think he would be intimidated, because he was so gracious with the family. And he has six sons himself, I think.
Wow.
I'm sorry, three sons himself. So he knows what it's like to be a father, and he even said to my boys, so you think you know it all, right? You think your mom doesn't know anything, huh? Because you're already, you know, teenagers. And they're like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, I guess again.
Well, you know, it's funny that we said education. I get that so much from people that are in a position like he is. Pat and I went to, I can't remember what performance we went to, but we sat next to a dancer who was with the Jodhpur Ballet. And Pat said, had been, I don't know if I think he retired, but he gave the same advice to Pat when she said, our daughters are dancers. he said, make sure they get an education, because even if they get good enough to be professional dancers, when you have to retire at 35 years old, you right. need something else to do in life, right? Because it's not something you get to do, and very few people get to do it to begin with, and even fewer get to do it into their 40s and 50s.
And true. And I misspoke how he went to Villanova. But again, it wasn't, you know, a Big Ten school.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
And no more for their basketball team, actually, than their football team, I think. They have a really good basketball team. Yeah. But anyway, we're getting diversity in is a very important thing. And I often use the example of my sister, who was 10 years older than I was. She was one of a handful of women. I mean, I think I could have counted them on one hand that graduated from GW Law School when she graduated from GW in the early 60s. And then she went back to be part of the ceremonies in the 1980s, late 1980s, and there were more women graduates than there were men. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the more women that you get in there, the more women you're going to see.
Well, that's interesting because I have a friend who's a college guidance counselor. She helps shepherd juniors and seniors in high school into colleges, and she told me today that it's 55% female and 45% male in the college applicant pool today.
Well, you know what? I got to be honest with you. As soon as we, now I'm not sure I'll live to see this, but as soon as we get in a position where women are running the world, we'll be in a hell of a bit better position than we are today, in my humble opinion. You know,
I think we women know that. I'm surprised to hear you say that. You're a feminist, aren't you?
Well, you know, I'm a theoretical feminist. I don't believe in feminism for my wife or daughters. But for all other women on the planet, yes, absolutely.
That's not true. But I see how you are with your wife. I would say you're humble and deferential, and you're not the ego in the room, and it's not your roost that you roll. And
Please stop, because my wife's about to run in here and grab the microphone from me and go, what?
What are you talking about? That's not the wife that I'm married to.
I'm only humble because she's smarter than I am and tougher than I am. And so, I'm smart enough to know, you know, you don't pick a fight with Mike Tyson. I'm that smart, you know. But
because you came from an Italian Catholic background, so you could be a little more macho, if you will, if I'm going to make a gross generalization, because those cultures can be, the men lead and et cetera.
Well, you know, it's funny that in the Italian family I grew up in, my grandmother's house, there was an absolute separation of power. Absolute separation of power. So outwardly, it looked like men were in control of everything because they were outside the house. But everything inside the house was my grandmother's domain. And nobody had any, even her own children didn't have anything to say about it. If my mother told me to do something and my grandmother said, you don't need to do that, then I didn't need to do it. She was the supreme commander, and there was this great separation of power, and it worked. Of course, my grandmother was a very tough lady, but when it came to the family or the kids or church or anything that involved the family, that was her domain. Everything outside the house was my grandfather's domain. But, you know, I was lucky in that I had my mother's family was, I guess there's no other way to say it, but racist. They believed every stereotype about every ethnic group. My father, on the other hand, who was not really that fond of people in general, believed that everybody was equal, that men, women, didn't matter what ethnic group you came from, that everybody, there was the same amount of good people and bad people in every group and smart people in every group. And, you know, and he taught us to embrace all cultures and all types of people. You know, he believed that women were every bit as smart. He pushed my sister, you know, first member in my family to graduate from college, and she went on to graduate from law school and become a partner in a big law firm. And that was all because my dad, from the time she came into the world, you know, told her she was smart and she could do anything and she shouldn't let any barrier stand in her way. You know, my mother and her family kind of felt like it was great for Pat to go to law school because she could meet a nice lawyer there and get married. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But not my dad. My dad was like, you could be on the Supreme Court. You could be, you know, and if she lived long enough, she might have been on the Supreme
Well,
Court.
Well, how progressive of him. Because my folks said you have to get a college degree so that if your husband dies, you need to be able to support yourself.
Right. I mean,
and that's not, that's kind of your parents' generation.
Yeah.
It was about getting the MRS, really, going to college, which I didn't. I didn't get married till I was 26. So, I had a career and everything before that. My own business.
And I think, you know, and we've tried to bring our girls up that way, you know, and I do have two really strong opinionated girls, and you know what, and sometimes I lament about their brother. I go, poor Nick, he was the middle child and he had to grow up in between these two strong girls, but you know, they all love and respect each other, and we're proud of that. We're very proud of it, and they've all gone their own direction so far in life, so we'll see where they end up. But it's just silly that we're not more representative in the hierarchy of our government. When I train Native Americans, that's the first thing we say to them. We say, look, if you don't have a seat at the table, your interests are not addressed. In fact, if you're not sitting at the table, you may actually be on the menu. So, you know, you need to be there. You need to have people there. They have to have a position so that your interests are reflected in everything that's considered.
But to that end, Michael, sorry to interrupt, California had to have a law that mandates that public companies have at least one woman on their board by the end of last year. And by 2021, that they should increase. And that had to be legislated.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's the one thing about California. They're ahead. You know, they legislate many things before the rest of us come around to it. You know, there's also a thing, one of my favorite things in campaigning is a thing called the California law. That's what we refer to it as. And it says that if there's a million potential ballots going out in an election, and you and I are running against each other, half of them have to have your name in the top position, and half of them have to have my name in the top position because they found that people that are first on the ballot have a decided advantage. And this is a law they passed 20 years ago. Now, I don't know if that involves federal elections or not, but it certainly does a lot of local elections.
Interesting. Because California was the first to pass that legislation. But I'm saying, if we're 50% of the talent pool, why aren't we 50% of the makeup of anything? Yeah. And so for them to legislate one, and then by 2021, it's three. And again, it's publicly held companies, not private. So they don't have.
Right. Well, Maria, are you still there? Are we still on the air? I can't hear anything, guys. Okay. All right. I'm sorry for our listeners for that. But let me tell you, let's get Maria back. What I really want to talk about next, too, is the Georgia election. I don't know if you're there, Maria, but, you know, we have a runoff election in Georgia. It's very important. It's going to make a difference between whether Democrats control the Senate or not. And given the way Mitch McConnell has acted over the past 4 years, I think it's really important for the Democrats to control the Senate so that we can move a Biden agenda forward. If not, he's going to consistently run into roadblocks in the Senate. So this election is just getting crazy in Georgia. More money has been spent in the state of Georgia for this special election than I think has ever been spent on election before. And in addition to that, there's been already, with early voting, now the election's not till January 5th, but already there's been 1.3 million votes cast, which puts it online to be the same type of election they had in the presidential election, which was the largest, we've already said, was the largest in American history. So this is probably going to be the largest runoff election they've ever had. And right now, we see the Democrats and the Republicans, both in both cases, within less than a point of each other. In the case, as of the 18th of December, between Perdue and Ossoff, there's a 0.7%, 0.7%, less than 1%. And between Reverend Warnock and Loeffler, there's a 0.2 difference between the two of them. I mean, that's just crazy. It's crazy that it's that close. And they're spending millions. I mean, tens of millions of dollars are pouring into the state. And this is really coming down to, you know, what the future of the United States Senate is going to be like, and probably the future of what the Biden administration is going to be able to do.
Well, Biden campaigned there this week.
Yeah, and Trump just announced that he's going to have a rally on January 4th, which is the day before
the election. Election. I wonder if that's going to blow back poorly on him, especially if he continues his antics as he seems to be doing.
You know what?
Out the weekend. People are saying he's not going to leave. I said, yeah, they're going to send in the federal parks people to hit him with a stun gun that they tranquilize bears with, and they'll knock him down and carry him out on a gurney.
Well, you know what? I mean, when you hear about some of the nutty things that are going on between, you know, firing this lawyer that they said was wearing a tinfoil hat because she was so crazy, you know, firing her, then bring her into the Oval Office and talking about a few weeks later making her a special counsel. And to have former staff people stand up and say they should declare martial law.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just crazy. But none of that's going to happen. But nonetheless, we're going to have to find a way for the 80 million of us to reach out to the 74 million that, you know, voted for Donald Trump. And together, we're going to have to find a way to move forward, especially in this pandemic. So I feel, you know, my personal interests in the Georgia election are that the Democrats take both seats so that we can get statehood into the United States, D.C. statehood into the United States Senate, and have a chance of passing it. Of course, to do that, even with even if we win both, we win both seats, it's a tie. And then, of course, Kamala Harris gets to be the deciding vote because she's president pro tempore of the Senate. But even if we were able to do that, we'd have to suspend the rules to get rid of the filibuster, what they call the nuclear option. That's only been done twice, to my recollection, in the United States Senate. So that's not an easy thing to do. So even if we take over the Senate, it's a Hail Mary pass, but mm-hmm. to use a sports analogy. But it's nonetheless a chance, which we don't otherwise have.
Well, along those lines, though, they say that Rupert Murdoch got the vaccine in the UK, even though Fox News voting misinformation about the vaccine itself. And he's the parent, right, of that entity.
Yeah.
So and I guess Tucker Carlson did something that was a meltdown about the vaccine. And I have heard Trumper people are turning against him because he's saying that the vaccine works. So they're getting disenfranchised even within the following of Trump. So,
well, you know, and that's a problem, right? Is that we're so deeply rooted in this dislike of each other, and we've got to get over that, right? We absolutely have to get over it. You know, it when I hear people on both sides talk about each other, and it's both sides talking about each other, I say to myself, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, it's like, you know, it's like listening to people talk about people they really dislike, like their ex-wife or something. Oh, she got the car. Yeah. She got the house. And all I got was the Elvis records and, the barbecue grill. That kind of tension and dislike for each other. I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't dislike people that live in Utah, you know? So I don't know what the animosity, why it's so become so vicious but I've got somebody texting me saying, why don't we root out corruption? Why don't we have a platform rooting out corruption? There was no corruption. That's why. Let's be very clear about this for people out there that might be considering that this election was somehow rigged. This is absolutely crazy. The Donald Trump was in control of the government. He was in control of the court system that, you know, as far as an executive can be, the courts found there was no corruption. There isn't any corruption. The way to get corruption out of politics is to get the money out of politics. Okay? You know,
people, and how do you do that?
You publicly finance elections. You don't allow people to buy elections. You don't allow people to contribute. Look, in Georgia, we may be talking as much as $50 to $100 million in a state election. You get that money out of there. You make sure the public finances election. So you don't consider political action groups and corporate fundraisers individuals. You don't use the same laws to regulate them. You extend the terms of members of Congress. No member, look, if you know this, Maria, if you are a representative, you have to campaign constantly. You have to constantly raise money, because as soon as you won one campaign, the next campaign starts. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
that,
I agree.
That members
Especially
of Congress
two-year
have
terms.
A two-year terms. Right.
That's,
make it a four-year term.
Yes.
You know, and then they have time to legislate beyond having to suck up to people to get their money so that they can keep their job. Just imagine, I say this to people all the time, just imagine that you had to go before, let's say you worked for General Motors, you didn't have to go before your boss every 2 years to see if you could keep your job. You had to go before every employee at General Motors to see if you could keep your job. This is not an easy thing to do. You have to convince people that you're doing a good job in order to get reelected. And people talk about term limits because we can't even take the time to care enough to do that job. You know, I mean,
but you know, look at Bloomberg spent all that money on Florida and that didn't do anything about that. And that other candidate who had the most donations, he didn't win.
It's not always about money.
Yeah.
It's not always about money, but it is very often about pandering, whether the money helps or not. You know, it's about pandering. It's about, just imagine that you've gone. To use the football analogy again, you've gone onto the field and the other team has equipment on and you're playing in your t-shirts and shorts. What chance you have to win the game at a professional level? That's how campaigns are approached. They go, oh my God, he's got $10 million and we've got $2 million. How can we compete? And sometimes, you know what? The person with $2 million wins. I don't know.
Well, Hillary Clinton outspent Trump by almost 2-1.
Yeah. And look, when I was in, and that's been a big problem, because when I worked at the DNC, I was a fundraiser. I was a direct mail fundraiser. And for every dollar we raised, the Republicans raised almost $10. They outspent us 10-1. Now that's not the case anymore. Mm-hmm. Now we spend as much or more money than they do. When I worked for Jimmy Carter, working on his election, I think we might have gotten up to $100 million being spent on the election. But today, there's more than $2 billion. That's a 2,000% increase in the money that's put into elections. And so the first thing you do to root out the corruption is to get money out of the system. And you also, need to prosecute people that violate the rules. You need to be all over that because, working in politics, in the public interest should be considered an honor. It should be, and it comes with great responsibility. It's not a privilege. It's not to have a privileged existence. It's to be there to represent the people that sent you. And you know what? When the Senate was founded, senators were paid no money at all. And they were given $7 a year. $7 a year.
Really?
Stipend. That was their stipend. Their expenses were covered to $7 a year, and they were paid no salary. But you know, want to know what? I get lambasted all the time because I'm not paid. People go, you're not paid? And I go, no, I'm not paid. Well, why would you do that? That's so stupid. I do it because it needs to be done.
Well, which is admirable.
It's well, like,
Trump calling the people suckers and losers who right. died for suckers defending our country.
Well, we're out of time, Maria, but it always goes quickly. And next week, I'm hoping that we will play an hour's worth of Christmas music like we did last year for people to enjoy. Maria and I are going to go put our masks on and spend time with our families. Are your kids coming home at Christmas?
They are not.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Mine are here.
And my birthday is early next year, and it's going to be a quiet one. It's just, it's what is COVID, right?
Not on Shadow Politics. We're going to sing happy birthday to you on your birthday.
It's January 5th, the day that Georgia is elected.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, how often does a woman turn 30? We're going to have to make a big deal. out of it. But anyway, I'm going to leave you tonight. We're going to leave you, Marie and I, with my Christmas. You know, this is a song I play every year at Christmas. We always leave you with a song. But this is really my hope for the world. It's more my Christmas prayer than it is my Christmas song. And it's by Stevie Wonder. And the title of the song is Someday at Christmas. So Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and Happy Holidays.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Someday at Christmas, men won't be boys, playing with bombs like kids play with toys. One warm December, our hearts will see a world where men are free.
In the capital of this nation, 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.